Welcome to the Biz News Edge. It's Thursday, the 9th of July. I'm Alec Hogg. In today's show, DA insider, former party spokesperson, and now basic education minister Siviwe Gwarube on the fallout from John Steenhuisen's explosive interview on whether DA ministers have actually delivered and why she says 2029 is the DA's to win or lose. What an interview. But first, three stories you need to know today. Dr. Anthea Jeffrey, whose argument is on biznews.com, warns that South Africa is about to repeat Europe's costliest mistake. Dr. Jeffrey is the head of research at the Institute for Race Relations. She sees it very clearly and tells it like it is. Well, the DA's new environment minister, David Manier, remember he's taken over that role because after Steenhuisen was demoted, Willie Oukamp has moved into agriculture, opening the way for Manier, who did a pretty good job running the Western Cape's education department. But boy, has he got a hot potato here. He has got on his desk draft climate change regulations. They include things like mandatory carbon budgets, fines, big ones, even jail times for directors who happen to be sitting on companies that don't toe the line. Of course, Eskom is right in the crosshairs here and its whole coal fleet of power stations, which only recently the parastatal has said it wants to keep going for a lot longer than everyone anticipated, they could be bringing in big fines if this legislation goes ahead. Well, what Dr. Anthea Jeffrey has explained in this article, and it's not the first time I've seen this, I was bombarded with this information when I attended the ARC conference in London last year, which said, just have a look at where this road towards net zero leads. Germany has lost 300,000 industrial jobs chasing it. That's only since 2019. Now the 150,000 jobs are on the line and expected to be gone this year. 4 in 10 German manufacturers are today considering leaving the country because they just can't manage under the rules that the politicians have put in there. In the UK, business electricity prices are up over 2/3 since 2019. Oil refineries have collapsed from 18 to just 4. Chemical output is down by 45%. And all of this from parts of the world that are a fraction of the output or the carbon emissions compared with China, whose carbon emissions, by the way, are going up. So what the heck is it all about? And indeed, why are we in South Africa, who are a speck on the carbon emission table, bothering to hurt ourselves in this way? It looks like a story of self-harm. Dr. Jeffrey has given it a full report. You can read that on BizNews. Story two comes from The Economist. It's their leader today, also republished on biznews.com. It's about a guy called Andrei Melnichenko. Now, you might not have heard of him, but he's the biggest industrialist in Russia, and he's known as the world's fertilizer king. Now, that's pretty important. So why does it matter here to us in South Africa? Well, Melnichenko's companies are amongst South Africa's largest fertilizer suppliers. So our farmers' costs are effectively being held hostage here to Moscow. The Economist spoke to Melnichenko, who's in Russia and known as a Putin-aligned insider, for something like 60 hours of interviews before putting together the story that is certainly rocking the Kremlin today. He warns this oligarch that a code of silence within Russia is heading the country towards one of three bleak futures: anarchic collapse, domination by China, or North Korean-style isolation, none of which appeal to him, nor would they appeal to anybody who is looking for economic growth. There's a historical echo for us, too, South African business leaders made exactly the same case to the National Party in the late apartheid years. That time round, the National Party listened to the pleas for reform because they could see that instability would gut the economy. Indeed, in 1985, after that infamous speech that P.W. Botha made in Durban at a local party congress, this was subsequently termed the Rubicon speech because he spoke all about crossing the Rubicon and did anything but it. The Rubicon reference had been in the original speech, which he decided in a fit of pique to change. Well, that brought on a very strong retribution from the rest of the world. They froze all South Africa's debt and said, you have to repay it. And the economy took an awful hiding as a result. Those who were around at the time will remember 25% interest rates as capital was extremely short. But the point here is when the people who profit from the status quo, and that's the oligarchs in Russia, start saying that things need to change, start sounding an alarm, that's a signal worth taking seriously. And it complicates Pretoria's bet that Russia is a stable partner, indeed, a member of BRICS. Farmers need to watch this very closely. And the last of our three stories today is a value investing story. And who would have thought? NVIDIA, which has shed roughly $1 trillion in market cap since May, just the other day, has now got itself into a position, or the shares have, where they are better value than the average of the other 499 shares on the Wall Street S&P 500 index. Yet profits at NVIDIA keep climbing, and NVIDIA's share of the server AI chip market is still north of 90%. The shares are cheaper than NASDAQ on average, Hershey's, and of course, as mentioned before, the average of the S&P 500. This isn't a company in trouble, though. It's a rotation by the desk jockeys. They're chasing memory chip makers like Micron rather than staying with NVIDIA. Analysts still overwhelmingly rate NVIDIA as a buy, as you should, given its prospects and its market shares. Targets are implying over 50% upside in the stock. When sentiment, not earnings, drives a share price, that's not the moment to look away and certainly not to sell. That's the time to have a very much closer look. NVIDIA, well, it's one that we may be looking at very closely as well in the BizNews portfolio come our changes on the last Tuesday of every month as we reassess market conditions. And so now to today's main event, our anchor interview. Basic Education Minister Siviwe Gwarubi has been at the heart of the DA for many years. In fact, she joined it when she was 19. That's pretty much half of her life she spent in the party. She was its national spokesperson, its public face. And this week, she's fielding pointed criticism, particularly after yesterday's interview, which you would have seen on the BizNews Edge, with Franz Kronier, who said that education is one of the portfolios that's in a mess, to use his terms. France reckons that not all the DA ministers, in fact, he found it difficult to mention one, have been shining in government. And as a result of that, it puts a question mark against the story that the DA is selling to the public. Well, I put that and other interesting questions to the DA's basic education minister. The full interview, which runs to over half an hour, can be seen on the director's cut. But here we kick off with my question to her about xenophobia and how that impacts the children of undocumented foreigners in South Africa who are attending South African schools. How does the department handle that?
Because South Africans, in my view, are not intrinsically xenophobic. South Africans are frustrated. They're frustrated because it takes hours for them to get into a clinic. It's hard for them to get their children into a school because of the pressures. You know, jobs are hard to come by. Young people, over almost half of the young people in South Africa, 7 out of 10 young people in South Africa are unemployed. So I think the frustration is mostly because I can't make a life for myself. And it feels as though the person who comes from another country is able to do so. So, and that is often what we have to deal with. And what I often explain to people is that Section 29 of the Constitution is unequivocal about saying every single child has a right to education. It doesn't say every South African child. And this was also affirmed by a High Court judgment in 2019, where the court said, your own South African children, many of them are undocumented. So if you start talking about documentation or not documentation, you're going to start discriminating against children who are not responsible for whether or not they documented. We've got many stories of children who were raised by grandmothers, moms, and dads who walked out, and they are not documented. And, you know, one of the things that we've been looking at, some of the data we've been looking at, is just how many South African children are undocumented. And so that's also why we want to bring Home Affairs closer to our process. And that's why this interministerial committee with other departments for ECD is important, so that we can start documenting children, even at ECD level. So you're right. These are complicated issues. But I think what ought to happen is we must always be guided by key principles of humanity, of really, really being really committed to the principles of our Constitution. I think we will fare well if we do that. And then we all, as leaders who've been elected, we all need to pull our part. We all need to do our part. Whether you're in local government, provincial government, national government, because when one sphere of government fails, it's got a ripple effect on everybody else. And I come from the Eastern Cape. So I have seen the profound failure of local government where I come from. My town looks a shadow of its former self from when I used to live there in Buffalo City. So I can see, you know, like no young person would want to live in Buffalo City. It's not possible. So yeah, I'm passionate about people. All of us need to pull our parts.
It's a very important point that you make there. Thanks for doing that again. I spoke yesterday to Frans Cronje, and I need to get your response to this, because he started talking about agriculture being in a mess with John Steenhuisen. And he said, yes, and the DA ministers haven't really shone. And he then said, education's in a mess, and then went on to the other departments. How would you react to that kind of criticism?
Look, I mean, I think people are at liberty to criticize, as much as possible. But I also think that one of the things I think as a party we've learned, and perhaps maybe France could gain from this, is we've always understood that education is going to be an investment. I'm not in the business of cutting ribbons. So if your barometer for success is how many ribbons are you cutting? How many schools are you handing over? Then there's a misunderstanding of what the national minister ought to do and what the national minister is responsible for. And so we've got to understand that you are changing a system. It's system-led changes. They're going to take time to yield fruit. They're going to take time for us to see children thriving by five. It's going to take time for children to start reading for meaning, and for us bringing down that number of 8 out of 10 children who can't read for meaning. Those are the things we are obsessing. I'm obsessing about. I'm less obsessed about, you know, opening a school somewhere, but I'm mostly obsessed about, is the curriculum branch in the department looking at what ways can we utilize to teach foundation phase maths? Are we doing the right thing? What is the rest of the world doing to make sure that we are teaching foundation phase maths well so that children can thrive? So, the DA had to come to terms with that. And I'm glad you asked this question, because often people say, you know, but, you know, there are no good stories that come from the department. Of course, This is one of those departments where you're responsible for 13.7 million children. If anything happens to any of them, you have to answer. 24,000 schools, 500,000 teachers. So it's a big system that has got delegated powers, concurrent powers, which limits your ability to control certain things. But at the end of the day, Alec, I think you've got to understand that an investment is that. You're investing now for a future outcome. So I would say to France, it would be really deeply unfair to try and say it's a mess in 2 years of having taken on the role. I think that he can judge the performance of my term when we leave, and whether or not the inverting of the pyramid, the reorientation of the basic education sector, is actually what we needed to do. And I personally think that he may start to agree that that's what we needed to do.
You are right in the heart of the DA, having been the spokesman, the face of the party for a long time. Now the interview that your former leader had is all kinds of speculation about the knock-on effect for the DA in the elections just around the corner, all kinds of speculation on why is he staying as a deputy minister when he's blown up the place. What's your read on all of this, given that you're probably the best person in the organization to be able to help us, because that's kind of an area where you're an expert in?
Look, I mean, I think firstly, you know, it was important for John to, you know, set the record straight about especially his performance as the Minister of Agriculture and his handling of FMD, and I think it would have been deeply unfair to say that he ought not to make to account for his time, but I think my wish, Alec, really is that if we're going to be the biggest party in 2029, I really want us to focus a lot more on our voters and what our voters and South African voters, to encourage them to come out to vote. Because ultimately, if we are too inward facing, voters are turned off by that. They are saying, well, I mean, you are mostly focused on your own drama, and you're not talking about how you're going to create jobs should you be in office. And that's why I decided to put my hat in the ring back in April, and to say, you know, I want to be part of the leadership of this organization, because I can't outsource the growing of the party to other people if I'm not prepared to be part of the solution. And so I think that is part of the reason why I wanted to be a deputy chairperson. And so I really want to urge my party, I think, when we do meet as the leadership, to say, you know, we need to be focused on performing very well in this local government election, but then we need to have our eye on 2029. Because in my view, Alec, I think South Africa's best chance is having the DA being the biggest party come 2029, and perhaps even looking at a different formation of a government of national unity or a coalition government. I think that we are at a place where we can do that, but it will be ours to lose. And so it's very important that we become, you know, outward focused and about winning votes.
So if I read you correctly, you say that John Steenhuisen had every right to do that interview.
Well, I'm saying he has a right to talk about his time as the Minister of Agriculture and his handling of FMD and other issues. I mean, if I were to leave my portfolio, I would want to reflect on my time here and what I did, and, you know, some of the lessons that I've learned. And I think it would have been unfair to not expect him to be able to have a reflection. What has transpired? Look, I am not in a position to be able to talk to the issues that have come out of that interview, because I have not had any interactions with any of those individuals or that company. So for me, it's difficult to weigh in on something that, you know, I am not part of, or I wasn't, you know, privy to. But as I said, I think any person who has put in 2 years of work would want to be able to reflect on what they've done. But I think it's important that as a party now, we shift our gaze mostly to November 3rd and how we're going to enthuse voters who've never voted for the DA before. And one of the key things, Alec, in my view, is we need to move away from just being a party of competence, but being also a party of compassion. And that also means saying we understand where people are coming from, their frustrations, and what are we going to do about it? Because ultimately, we can't also just only rely on clean audits and say, you know, we've got to be a compassionate organization where people can say, I see myself reflected there. I see that these are people who understand my realities. And so I think as being the most diverse political party in South Africa, we can do that. So that's why I'm saying it would be ours to lose to being the biggest party in 2029. We can achieve it, but we need to be a lot more focused and turn our gaze towards the voters and less so on ourselves.
So it sounds a bit like I remember Maria Ramos making this point a while ago, many years ago, when she said we should not waste a good crisis. Now, the DA's got a good crisis right now. If I read between the lines, that's really what you're saying. Come on, let's learn from this and maybe make sure that we can put it to good effect.
Yeah, I think there's plenty for us to learn over the last 2 years since the election. I think also one of the things that we have learned, and I think we ought to also reflect on that, Alec, a little bit, is we've learned a little bit about how to run a coalition government that no one wants to call a coalition government, and we call it a government of national unity. But, you know, it is a coalition government, and how to be part of a coalition government with an organization that is still going through 5 stages of grief. And so, you know, there's acceptance on one day and then the other day, you know, there isn't, you know, there's denial. And so there's plenty of lessons I think we've learned. And I think that's why I'm saying we have a unique opportunity here to be the biggest party in 2029. But that means performing well, winning Johannesburg, winning NMB, but decisively, not like we did in 2016, decisively winning and coalescing with people who share our values so that we can have a lasting impact where we are there for 4 or 5 years. So that's important, because what we've seen in the city of Joburg of having 9 mayors in 11 years, it has been catastrophic for the city. So I think my view is we have to be focused on winning these metros so that we can demonstrate what we can do, particularly to poor Black South Africans, so that they can start voting for the DA. We've seen what we are able to do in Mfuleni, and I think we can replicate that across the country.
The full interview is really interesting. I liked the fact that she referred to a parallel story that we know about wise men plant trees that they know they will never sit in the shade of. She was saying where she's focusing her attention now, and this is an area where Minister Gwarube has had a lot of success, even her critics will admit it, is in the littlies, the basic education under the age of 10. And there's more investment that is being made there, and the investment, she says, will be there for keeps, even if she doesn't happen to be running the portfolio or indeed even be in government in years to come. And that to her is the most satisfying thing. She's making a case that reform is a slow burn investment. And as a party insider, she tells us that the DA's turmoil could be the making of it if it stops looking inward. So what do today's insights mean for you? Well, watch those draft carbon regulations. If Pretoria pushes ahead regardless, then energy-intensive sectors, read Eskom, our energy prices, electricity prices, think Sasol, are going to carry some very, very heavy regulatory risk. And it would mean that once again, ideology is trumping practical approaches towards an economy that is, well, we won't say it's on its knees because the private sector always seems to find a way out, but it certainly is in a lot of trouble when you consider what the official unemployment rate is. That has to be turned around. Anthea Jeffrey argues why. There's a DA minister in that portfolio. The country, or the party rather, cannot afford to have another foot shooting off exercise akin to what John Steenhuisen did recently. You also have to watch Russia's stability as closely as the weather if you're a farmer, because one doesn't know what will happen to the fertilizer output there if this oligarch, who's now spoken out against Putin, despite being one of his most closely aligned industrialists and the biggest industrialists overall in Russia, is punished in some way. And then treat NVIDIA's $1 trillion drop in market value as a possible entry point, not a red flag. If the analysts who are right, the ones who are covering NVIDIA, well, then you certainly will be looking back on this in time to come as a pretty happy day. Well, that's The Edge for today. For more, head over to biznews.com. I'm Alec Hogg. Until Monday, cheerio. In uncertain times, good information is priceless. The BizNews Conference is heading back to the Drakensberg. Join me, Alec Hogg, from the 11th to the 14th of August for BNC9, Champagne Sports Resort, where it all began and where our community gathers for honest conversations, smart investing insights, and direct access to some of South Africa's sharpest minds. Come and rub shoulders with the best we've got. 28 keynote speakers, 3 days. Seats are available now. Book your seat by clicking the link in the description. Start your day a step ahead. BizNews Insider. It delivers the business stories that matter every morning straight to your inbox, sharp, fast, and free. Subscribe now.